physical protection system, which is a collection of barriers like fences and walls and technology like cameras and intrusion detection and processes and procedures like two-person working rules and background checks and all of these sorts of things. They're a lot like a piano. You can't tell if a piano's in tune by looking at it. You have to play it.
Welcome to The Flux Capacitor, a podcast about the future of electricity. I'm Francis Bradley of Electricity Canada. This is number 105, episode 105 of The Flux Capacitor. That's more than 100 conversations about the future of the business of electricity. I've chatted with the industry's business leaders, thought leaders, new market players and stakeholders, the folks that have been pondering the future of how we create, move, trade, and use energy, and what the future changes will mean for electricity companies, regulators, society, and customers. I hope these conversations have given you, the listener, a sense of the conversations that are taking place in the sector, on coffee breaks at industry conferences, on the margins of regulatory hearings, or over a drink following a parliamentary committee appearance. This episode of the pod is a deep dive into security issues. My guest on the podcast today is...
My name is Ross Johnson. I'm the president of Bridgehead Security Consulting Incorporated, and I am also the senior fellow for Electricity Canada, advising on security and emergency management.
Ross recently published the second edition of his book, Anti-Terrorism and Threat Response, Planning and Implementation. We talk about the genesis of the book and what it is seeking to convey. We also talk about the role of the security practitioner. We take a detour into the visa process and the design basis threat concept and the need for integration of security measures. We close the conversation with Ross's recommendation for a book to add to the Flux Capacitor Book Club. Here is my conversation with Ross Johnson, recorded on Zoom in late December 2024. Ross, welcome to the podcast. Let's talk about a book for starters.
Okay.
A book that you have just published. And that was, it wasn't the only reason why I wanted to get you on the podcast, but I did want to talk about this book because you were kind enough to ask me to write the foreword to this book. So Anti-Terrorism and Threat Response, Planning and Implementation. This is the second edition. I guess the first question that the listener probably has is, why write a book about anti-terrorism planning?
Because there isn't any. There hasn't been one.
Okay.
Thanks. This whole sort of project started with me back after around 9/11. Mm-hmm. So 23 years ago.
Right.
And what happened was the whole security industry, politics, everything suddenly reoriented toward terrorist attacks. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I found was that the time was all spent on how to recover from terrorist attacks.
Okay.
There was nothing on actually how to prevent them. And as a result, there was this idea that terrorist attacks were like lightning, that you couldn't accurately predict if it was coming and there was nothing you could do about it. Mm-hmm. And all you could do later on is pick up the pieces afterwards. So I was working in the security industry back in those days. I was the intelligence director of Air Security International in Houston, Texas. And I got something from a reserve sergeant, I think. And it was a PowerPoint presentation on the Department of Defense's anti-terrorism planning fundamentals. And it was really, really simple. There were five simple pieces to it. Mm-hmm. And that's how the U.S. Department of Defense prevents terrorist attacks.
Right.
So what I did was I started to look at it. I started doing presentations on it in Houston. And I'll never forget the reaction of a young lieutenant from the Coast Guard. Mm-hmm. And at the end of it, he comes up to me and he's almost got tears in his eyes. And he's saying, thank you so much for this. He said, I've always had this sense that there's nothing we can do and that we're powerless in the face of terrorism. But what you've shown is that there is actually something that we can do, that we can prevent it from happening. And so after that, I thought, well, I should write a book about this. And then I scotched that idea because I was at a ASIS conference in Houston, in Dallas. Mm-hmm. And I ran into a guy who was the security director for Texas Instruments. And he says to me, ever since 9/11, everybody's been telling me that I have to protect my facilities from terrorist attacks.
Right.
He said, but nobody can tell me how. And I said, well, that's easy. So essentially, it's a very simple process. There are a number of steps. Essentially, you do a threat assessment, an accurate, realistic threat assessment, and you create security measures that will address the shortfalls that you found in your threat assessment. Then you come up with an observation plan. Because what you have to do is you have to watch for indicators that terrorists are planning an attack on your facility. And there's plenty of evidence that any terrorist worth his salt is not just going to show up someday and attack. They're right. going to spend time learning your security plan and learning your weaknesses and vulnerabilities so that they can exploit them in an attack. Mm-hmm. And then you come out, when you've completed this, you deploy what are called random anti-terrorism measures. So essentially what happens is once the terrorists are watching you, they're doing surveillance on your facility, they right. figure out what your plan is, right? And then, but what you do is you change your plan slightly every day so that they can't predict what tomorrow's going to look like. Mm-hmm. It could be something as really simple as like adding an extra guard on one day, and then another day deploying a mobile CCTV or lighting system, mm-hmm. or having random patrols by law enforcement. There's just small random anti-terrorism measures so that terrorists can't say, this is what you're going to look like tomorrow. Therefore, I'm going to attack you tomorrow, and I'm going to account for all these measures. And then the final component was response planning. What do you do if you're actually attacked? Mm-hmm. So I described these five fundamentals to him. It took about 3 minutes. And he said, you're right. That is easy. And there went my idea of writing a book, because I thought, if I can...
It's too easy. Okay, what's the point?
It's too easy. I could write a brochure or a pamphlet.
Yeah.
Anyway, so... another 10 years went by, and I thought more and more about it, and I realized there really is nothing out there mm-hmm. that tells professional security managers how to prevent terrorist attacks.
Right.
So maybe I will write a book about this. So what I did was I did the old self-publishing thing. I wrote a PDF, and I called it The Sword and the Shield, mm-hmm. which I ended up getting all these people saying, you know, that's the motto of the KGB. And I said, yeah, I know that. I was getting tired of being told the obvious. But what happened was a publisher found out about it and reached out to me and said, we want you to write a book on this. And so that's how the first edition of Anti-Terrorism and Threat Response came about. I published that, and it was great. It was good for me because it opened up a lot of doors and gave me a lot of opportunities. And then about 2 years ago, the publisher came back to me and said, time to write a second edition.
Right.
And so what I did was in the second edition, I chopped out at least 50% of what was in the first edition. Mm-hmm. And then what I did was I added sort of all the useful stuff that I've learned in the 10 years since. And what I really did was I enhanced two areas that were probably pretty weak in the first edition.
Right.
And one of them was the threat vulnerability assessment process. I just used sort of a standard one and showed it. And also the discussion on weaknesses and vulnerabilities. And in that area, I spent a lot of time studying that using a process that came out in the nuclear industry in 1977 called the VISA process, the Vulnerability to Integrated Security Assessment.
Yeah, and I want to drill down a little bit on VISA in a minute, but carry on, and we can circle back to VISA.
So what I did was I that's what I do now is I, one of the things I do now is I work for the North American Electric Reliability Corporation's EISAC doing substation security workshops. And in it, we use a design basis threat and we use the VISA process. Mm-hmm. And it's quite successful. The Department of Energy hired me and my partner facilitator back in 2019 and sent us over to Ukraine to to teach Ukrenergo this process. Yep. We were supposed to go six times. We went two times, and then the pandemic hit, and then the war. So
that's right. Like that. Yeah.
We've done this too with the Guam Power Authority on the island of Guam, mm-hmm. and we've taught it a whole bunch of times in the United States, and so far once in Canada.
Yeah.
So it is the best process that I've ever seen. So I've become kind of an evangelist
on it. Mm-hmm.
But what I did is in the book, at least five chapters are devoted to it, like 160 pages on the whole analytical process using the VISA methodology. And as far as I know, that is the only place you'll find it sort of available in print. There are no books. The whole thing came out of the 1977 presentation at a nuclear materials conference. And I saw a couple of slides from the presentation. And mm-hmm. so everything I know about it is stuff that I've learned from my partner facilitator and work done in the field. So yeah. What I've also done is I, to a large extent, adapted this process from something that was designed more for the nuclear industry. And I'm bringing it into the electrical utility sector.
Gotcha. Okay. So when looking at kind of the first edition, which was not, I guess, intended to be the first edition, it was just intended to be the book.
Yeah.
And then you've got the second edition. I mean, apart from the obvious of my name moving from an acknowledgement to writing the foreword, was that the most significant change, really pulling in VISA? And the VISA methodology to be much more significant in terms of the content of the book, or were there other changes as well? Because it is a very different book from I look at the first edition and the second edition, and I don't think I'm not sure it's accurate to simply call this the second edition, because often that simply means, you know, you've rewritten the foreword, but this is a lot of it is a brand new book.
It is, you're right, it's substantially different. The original book was about 200 pages.
Right.
And
yeah.
This one is over 500.
Yep.
And there are, and probably half the first book ended up on the cutting room floor in the second edition.
Yeah.
So a lot of stuff came out. A lot of it was because it was just, frankly, out of date.
I was going to ask, is it because the world changes, right? And
yes.
And things have changed and approaches have changed. There's new, better ways to do this planning and preparation.
There is. One of it is in the first book, there's sort of detailed assessment of terrorist measures in various regions of the world.
Yeah.
And those were based on data that is now 10 years older, right?
Right.
And it was less relevant.
Also,
the data, that kind of data is a little bit harder to get now.
Okay.
Because there's been tightening up of public access to information related to terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
And also, frankly, my definition of terrorism has changed.
Oh, and how so?
So there are, in the first edition, I talk about it, there's like 111 in the US, and 111 different definitions of terrorism.
Okay.
And I learned the definition that I use from a guy by the name of Bill Jordan, who ran the Intelligence and Combating Terrorism course in Fort Huachuca, Arizona, that I was a student on and later helped teach.
Mm-hmm.
And he said terrorism is an act of violence in where the victim is not the intended target.
Mm-hmm.
And so what that means is you kill a bunch of innocent people and you don't know them. You have nothing actually against them. You're killing them because you're trying to put pressure on the target. And the target is usually, say, the government.
Right. Yep.
And so that, for the longest time, was the sort of running definition that I would use of a terrorist attack. And it was by no means widely accepted. I was at a conference once in Houston, and the FBI and the State Department were there.
Hmm.
And I had trotted out my definition during the question and answer session at the end. I said, this is what I think the definition is. And I said, so for example, kidnap and ransom would be a terrorist act, because mm-hmm. the victim is the person tied up and hidden in the front of a car, but the target is the person with the deep pockets.
Right. Yeah.
And so at that point, the guy from the State Department harumphed and said, well, I can assure you the State Department does not view it that way. And there was an FBI guy up on the stage as well. And he grinned and he said, well, I can assure you that the FBI does see it that way. So, and of course, neither were speaking sort of officially for their organizations, but
yeah,
it was kind of an interesting show or an interesting split.
Yeah.
And the definition that I use now comes from a writer by the name of Lawrence Krauss. And I believe it was in 2016. And he wrote that terrorism was essentially acts of violence that are designed to drive apart communities that otherwise would exist perfectly well with each other.
Interesting. Okay.
And that really stopped me short and made me do a lot of thinking. And you look at it and you see that a lot of terrorist acts, actions that we see now, are designed to split communities, to divide the public.
Right.
And the interesting part of that is that it really places it on a continuum.
Mm-hmm.
And a continuum that a lot of people already exist in. So, and what I mean by that is if you look at the social media today, for example, a lot of the activities of social media are designed to find pain points or fissures between communities,
right,
and then hammer away at them. And we know that our adversaries in Russia and that they have internet farms where people sit there looking for these things, and then you deploying bots, et cetera, to try and amplify these fissures in communities.
Mm-hmm.
So really, terrorism is just the extreme end of the constant fight for attention and the constant fight for trying to on the one side, people are trying to unite communities, and on the other side, people trying to drive them apart.
Right. So when kind of thinking about what the net result would be if somebody implementing the sorts of things that are included in the book, doing, you know, all the planning and all the implementation, it occurs to me that it actually doesn't stop terrorism. What it is, I guess, intended to do is to shift the target away from you.
Exactly.
Right? Because this is not the cure for terrorism. It is the cure for them attacking you hopefully going somewhere else and attacking somewhere else, right?
Yes. As I see it, my job is not to stop terrorist attacks. My job is to make a terrorist go on and bother somebody else down the road that didn't have the common courtesy of buying my book or listening to one of my
books. that'll teach them.
So what you've done, though, is you've very neatly landed on the whole premise of the book, right?
Right.
The thing is that one of the things that we don't understand in the security sector is we don't understand what our jurisdiction is, what our role is.
Yeah. Okay. Yep.
So I have gone to so many presentations and seminars where people stand up and talk about counterterrorism, for example.
Right.
And they think that corporate security is part of the counterterrorism fight, and it really isn't.
Okay.
Right? Counterterrorism is the purview of governments and law enforcement and militaries and especially diplomats, diplomacy.
Yep.
And these are active measures that are designed to identify and disrupt and neutralize terrorist groups. Anti-terrorism is a passive process of measures that you take that simply communicate to terrorists that we are not an easy target and you cannot guarantee your success if you attack us. Because we know that terrorists will generally only attack targets where they are guaranteed or as close to possible guaranteed a success.
Right.
And they come out and told us that back in the 70s, Bader Meinhof, Andreas Bader, he said, we only go after places that don't have a plan.
Mm.
If we think you have a plan, we leave you alone.
And go down the road to another target.
So the whole purpose of this is to introduce doubt in the terrorist planning cycle.
Mm-hmm.
I used to work for a guy, here's a bit of a rat hole. I used to work for a guy who in the day worked in Northern Ireland and in policing, right?
Yep.
And he said that they captured a guy once.
I believe this is a mutual acquaintance of ours, the door to the story. Yes, carry on. Yeah.
So they captured a guy, they arrested a guy who was an IRA terrorist. Mm-hmm. And the terrorist was talking about a plan that they had, that they were going to go to a senior police officer's house during dinner. And they were going to go into the house and they were going to murder him in front of his family. And so this active service unit, which is what the IRA's direct action groups were called, mm-hmm. say he was in this area and they're doing surveillance on the neighborhood and on this guy's house to make sure that they understood all of the potential things that could interfere with their plan. And they saw a police officer walking by with this really strange looking weapon. Mm. Looked kind of futuristic. And they couldn't identify the weapon. And they said, there's something, this is unusual. This looks like something kind of futuristic. There's something that we don't recognize. Maybe it's a new type of weapon. So maybe this person is special troops, special forces of some sort. Mm-hmm. So maybe they're on to us. Maybe they know that we're planning on something in this area. And then paranoia took over and they convinced themselves that the police were lying in wait for them. And so they left the area and the man survived. Mm-hmm. It turned out what they saw was essentially a reserve police officer walking along the road carrying a Sterling submachine gun. Mm-hmm. A Sterling submachine gun was a World War II 9mm machine gun. I used them when I first joined the Army back in 1977. Mm-hmm. But they are strange looking things, and they are so strange that the Imperial Stormtroopers in Star Wars carried them. Because it was such an odd looking weapon, right? So because of this, it introduced doubt into their planning cycle. Mm-hmm. And they dropped the plan. That's what we're trying to do, is we're trying to introduce doubt into the terrorist planning cycle because we want them to go away and leave us alone. Now, having said that, we're also good citizens. And so what we use is while we are watching for indications that they are surveilling our facilities to attack us, we're using surveillance detection.
Right.
To detect this. And once we do, then we go to the counterterrorism people in Canada, it's the RCMP. Mm-hmm. And we go to them and we report what we've seen. And then what they do is they use a process called counter surveillance to figure out who these people are. And then they investigate them and then eventually disrupt the attack. And people go to jail. And the RCMP are really good at this. That's one of the reasons we have so few terrorist attacks in Canada, mm-hmm. is that the RCMP are so good at this. So what we're doing is we are deploying our resources to watch for terrorist attacks or the indicators of terrorist attacks. And what they are is surveillance, largely surveillance. Yeah. And then we're collecting that information and we're passing it to the counterterrorism people. And they are the ones that prevent the attack. Mm-hmm. So we work hand in glove with them. And I think it's really important that the security side, the professional security management side in our sector, understand what their role is, mm-hmm. so that they can do it properly. So, you know, we hear a lot about attribution, and I don't know how many reports I've read from, you know, governments and security agencies and all that about various terrorist groups. And you think, well, it's interesting from an academic point of view, but it actually has very little to do with the day-to-day work of preventing terrorist attacks on our facilities.
Right.
Because we don't go out and we are not in the counterterrorism business.
Yeah.
So that's one of the major points of the book is to teach security management. This is what your lane is. This is what mm-hmm. you have to get really, really good with. And then mm-hmm. when you see anything that looks like this, then you need to reach out to the counterterrorism people and you need to talk to them. And right. this is the sort of information you give them.
Yeah. Okay, so we talked a little bit about Visa. You mentioned design basis threat. That is, I think, another concept that is interesting and maybe one that asks you to do a little bit of an unpack.
Okay, so one of the problems that we have in security management is what are we actually protecting from?
Protecting from, okay, yeah. Yep.
What's the threat? What What does it look like?
Yeah.
And so if you ask a room full of people what they think the threat to their facilities are, you're going to get a room full of answers. Mm-hmm. And so it's very difficult. When you think about it, it's very difficult to design a physical protection system without knowing what you're actually protecting against. Mm. And it's a question that in our sector, it doesn't get asked often enough. And another problem is that when you're talking about threats, opinions become important. Anybody's opinion.
How so? As opposed to facts, right?
Well, yeah, because we're dealing with high impact, low frequency events. Mm-hmm. Generally, major attacks against facilities in our sector haven't happened yet. Mm-hmm. At least at a company level, like you just take a company that's and say, okay, have you had any major attacks in your sector? And they say, no, just usually copper theft and theft right. of tools and equipment. But let's talk about terrorist attacks. But we haven't had one yet. Not really right. big. And so it's difficult to imagine what the threat would look like if it hasn't shown up yet. Mm-hmm. We have no direct experience in it.
Right.
And so what we did was in the electricity sector, back in 2015 or 2016, we put together a group of 25 people, experienced people, and we met in Atlanta and with NERC, and we created the design basis threat for the electricity sector. Mm-hmm. And it was a really interesting process because we had to get together and agree with what a threat would look like. So, and when we talk about what it would look like, we'd say, okay, how many people, if you're talking about a substation attack, what's the maximum number of people? Now, I'm not going to get into the actual numbers mm-hmm. in the design basis threat because it is naturally a sensitive document mm-hmm. and it's not available publicly.
Yeah.
Only available to people in the sector. So, yeah. Yeah. But what it does is it tells you how many people as a maximum, you need to worry about. What types of tools and equipment and explosives, types of explosives, how much explosive do you expect them to have, etc. And what it does is it designs, you come up with a list of attributes, like a menu, mm. like a menu for an attack against a critical target, a high security critical target. What would an attack against that look like? What would an attack against a medium level target look like? And what would an attack against a low-level target look like?
Okay. And then what can you do with that?
So what you do is then you take this. You've got, this is, so in the high, let's say the critical asset, the high threat one.
Yeah.
We'd say, okay, this is the number, the maximum number of attackers. This is the kind of tactics they have. This is what they can do. So this is the menu that I have. And then what you do is you design a scenario that uses that. Now, another component of the design basis threat for your facility or your sector is what are called unacceptable consequences. Mm-hmm. This is a really important concept that does not get looked at enough in our sector. So what are the unacceptable consequences against an attack, of an attack against this facility? What is it that we actually don't want them to be able to do? And it's not enough to say, well, just attack the facility. No, no, no. What exactly is an attack? What would the consequence of an attack be that you would consider grave enough that you want to spend a lot of money to prevent it happening? Mm-hmm. So in most facilities, it's a simple one. The answer is fairly simple. Facilities exist for a purpose. So the first one would likely be anything that would prevent it from achieving its purpose.
Okay.
So electricity would be from supplying electricity. Anything that would stop it from supplying electricity. Mm-hmm. But then what you have to say is, well, for how long? Because we turn these things off all the time.
Right.
Sometimes, you know, short periods of time, et cetera. And you say, well, okay, anything beyond a certain boundary, like 7 days or a month or whatever. Mm-hmm. Right. So you describe those things that you think are too, that are unacceptable, that you want to prevent from happening. So you describe them, and those go into your design basis threat as well. So what you do is you take the design basis threat and you go and you look at the facility, at the site that you want to protect. Mm-hmm. And you look at the physical protection systems that they have in place, but then you also look for weaknesses and vulnerabilities, places where they might have a security measure in place, let's say like a camera, but yep. maybe it's not a very good one. Maybe it doesn't cover night particularly well. It only covers day. Or let's say it's you've got lighting systems that are adequate, except that there are certain areas where they're inadequate, where it's dark, that an intruder could come in. So what you're doing is you're looking for weaknesses and vulnerabilities, which is another thing that we don't do well in our sector. What I find that when people go to a site in security doing a threat vulnerability assessment, they generally spend a lot of time cataloging what they find, which is kind of a waste of time because the people on the asset know what's there to start with, right? And they don't spend enough time looking for these weaknesses and vulnerabilities, because I assure you that terrorists do look for them. That's why they're doing surveillance. That's why they're there. They're looking for weaknesses and vulnerabilities. So what we do is we find them. And then what we do is we take the design basis threat and the information that we have about the site. And then we say, okay, let's create a scenario that will exploit that exploits a weakness or a vulnerability that we found, and that it achieves one or more of the unacceptable consequences. Mm-hmm. And in the scenario, you have to say when it occurs. So you actually create, you say, you know, on Christmas Eve at 11 p.m., at 11 p.m., you know, adversaries showed up at the north end of the site. And then you talk about how they got through the fence, how they moved to whatever the asset, the critical asset that they're going to attack and destroy, and then how they leave. And then you take that and you take that information, and then you analyze your physical protection system. You break it down into steps, and then you say, okay, step one, pull up to the fence, and adversaries one and two approach the fence with bolt cutters.
That's right. Yeah.
And then you say, okay, what is the probability that anything in our physical protection system would detect that activity?
Right.
And if you've got cameras there, your probability of detection is probably pretty good. But if you've got nothing, well, you got nothing. Probability is very low. And then you say, okay, it's not enough to detect something. You have to actually assess that an attack is taking place. Detection could be a coyote walking past the fence. Assessment is, that's just a coyote. We don't need to worry about it.
Right.
So assessment means, what's the probability of assessing that there is an attack underway and that a call to law enforcement is placed? And then after that, it's the probability of engagement. What's the probability of law enforcement engaging these intruders? And then after that is probability of neutralization. What's the probability that they will stop the attack? So you work through each slice of your physical protection system, getting closer and closer to the critical asset, and that shows you how your physical protection system will behave, how it will respond. So what's really remarkable is the results is that the physical protection system as deployed usually fails. In fact, almost always fails, which is really disturbing to me as a physical security professional.
Yeah.
And the reason for it, I've got a lot of theories, but the problem is that when we install a physical protection system, that system can include fence line intrusion detection and access control systems and cameras and lighting and all that sort of stuff. When we install it one system at a time, right? Like, so you buy the cameras, they come in installed, and we do the acceptance testing, commissioning testing of the cameras. Do they work? Yes. Do they see to this point? Yes. Can I read the license plate over there? Yes. So you've met all of the requirements in the contract for the cameras, right? The problem is that we never test them all together. Never test all the security measures together as one. And it's a little bit like saying, like getting a bunch of musicians and saying, I want you to practice this piece, right? This particular piece I want to practice. And then you all suddenly show up at Carnegie Hall with a full audience and say, okay, have at her. You've all practiced the piece. Now we want you to play it. Well, of course
practiced
they
can. It individually. Yeah.
Yes, they've never done it together.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's why things fail, is that we keep deploying physical protection systems that we are not testing as a system. And so they fail. But anyway, this process, the visa process, what it does is it helps you identify these points of failure. And then what you do is you consider and propose upgrades that can that you can then use to improve the system. And then you rerun the scenario.
Yeah.
And you do this on a site until you've covered all the weaknesses and vulnerabilities. And so the way I look at it, and the way I sort of describe it, the most successful way of describing it, I think, is to say that a physical protection system, which is a collection of barriers like fences and walls and technology like cameras and intrusion detection and processes and procedures like two-person working rules and background checks and all of these sorts of things, right? All these components, they're a lot like a piano. Mm-hmm. And you can't tell if a piano is in tune by looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
You have to play it.
Right.
And so what this process does, and the one that I mentioned so thoroughly in the book, is essentially how to play the piano.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
How to test your physical protection system.
Yeah.
To see if it will behave. And the other really cool thing about this is I've done, my facilitator partner and I have done 28 workshops together.
Mm-hmm.
And the really interesting thing is that we've learned that often the most effective upgrades are either free or cost very, very little.
Right.
There was one example I can give you. We were doing an insider threat scenario. And it was a rogue employee showing up in the middle of the night to damage critical equipment, right? And so he was allowed into the facility because he's an employee, right? And so we said, well, what happens if you have more? They've gotten themselves to the point where they thought maybe there needs to be more scrutiny, right? So maybe an employee just can't show up at 2 o'clock in the morning and be let into a critical facility without providing some better reasoning.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they've usually got workflow authorization processes, right, or workflow processes. So they said, well, how about if we had a supervisor has to approve this particular work that he's going to do? And so when he tries to get in the middle of the night, they check the workflow to see if this is a scheduled maintenance or even emergency, but still that there's oversight, that yeah. there's supervisor oversight of this and approval. And then the IT guy in the room says, oh, hell, he says, that's just a checkbox. I'll do that on Monday when I get to the office.
Right.
So their system already had this built in.
Mm-hmm.
When they installed the system, they didn't understand the context of why it was there.
Yeah.
So they didn't check that box.
Right. Right.
So what we find is that often, especially in IT stuff, you've already got these things, these policies and procedures in place. You just haven't checked the box.
Gotcha.
You didn't understand the importance when you installed it.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, Ross, one of the things I ask people that come on the podcast is about their journey. And I do make the joke, you know, when you were a little kid on the playground, is this what you always dreamed of doing? I think it would be interesting to chat a little bit about your journey. And I do know a little bit about your journey, but I think the listener would be interested as well.
So thank you. I've always had kind of an eclectic set of interests,
mm-hmm.
and I've often been kind of driven by that. I guess the first one is when I was a kid, I used to do a lot of photography. I used to have my own dark rooms. I had several dark rooms. And I used back in the days of film when dinosaurs roamed the earth and Kodak.
Now, you know, I still use a lot of film. So
amazing. I was involved in photography at a young age and then I was looking for a career and I ended up sort of backing into the army. My dad suggested it. And I joined the army under the officer cadet training program. So I didn't have a university degree, but I joined the army and they accepted me. And then I became an infantry officer.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that for a number of years. But then I had to do extra regimental employment, they called it. But you just couldn't stay in an infantry battalion your entire career. You had to get out of the battalion every once in a while and see what the world looked like from the outside. So I had heard that there was computer training available. It was computer, you could work in the computer business in the military in Ottawa. And so I pushed for it and they sent me on it. And so I ended up going from an infantry battalion to the data center Ottawa in Tunney's Pasture, working in the computer business. And so this was back in, I guess, the 80s. And so we were still back in the big mainframe days, IBM System 370 and all that. And the desktops were just, like personal computers were just starting around that time. Anyway, I ended up with a three years or 4 years in computer systems analysis and programming. And then I saw an opportunity to rebadge to the intelligence branch. And there were hundreds of people that tried to get into the intelligence branch the year that I joined it. And only 16 of us were selected. And the reason they selected me was because I had a strong background now in computers. Now, in order to get in the intelligence branch, you had to come from like one of the combat arms or one of the sort of the pointy end things like the Navy, Mars officer in the Navy or whatever. So I was an infantry officer, so I had that box checked. Plus, I had a really good background in mainframe computing. And so they brought me in the intelligence business. And then I stayed in that for another 14 years. Had a great time, saw a lot of stuff, learned a lot of stuff. And then I ended up at Fort Huachuca, Arizona. And in those days, the Army was dying. Like, you remember the military, the late 90s, the wall had fallen. People were rapidly spending the peace dividend.
Yeah, the peace dividend, yeah.
Yeah, the military was shrinking. Opportunities were disappearing. So I was in Fort Huachuca as the Canadian Forces Liaison Officer for the U.S. Army Intelligence Center. And I did 4 years there and then left to join the private sector in Air Security International. And then, so now I'm in the private, or I'm in security management. And that became my second career. And I went from there to, my favorite client was an offshore oil driller. Atwood Oceanics. So I did 3 years with 3.5 years with Atwood Oceanics, saw the world, got to work on offshore oil rigs, which was an amazing experience. And then I did that for a few years. And then I saw an opportunity in Edmonton and I came back. So our family moved back from Houston to Canada. And largely what drove that was that Texas is a wonderful place and Houston was very good to us, but it is a tough place to live. When you're a Canadian, you get used to the programs that we have, like our medical system, etc. In the U.S. is a very tough place to work, especially if you're running the economy like that. We came back to Canada. I started as the head of security operations at Epcor Utilities, then became the security director, and then left when they split apart. I went with Capital Power, and then did that for a bunch of years. And in there, I had the pleasure of meeting you and what was then Canadian Electricity Association. The other thing, too, that I've learned over the years is that the Pareto's Law lives in most of what we do. It's the 80-20 rule.
Yeah.
And in the security business, like any organization or any profession, 80% of the people will stand around waiting for the other 20% to tell them what to do. And so I like writing and I like presenting. And so what I've been doing is writing books and doing presentations and et cetera, on security stuff for as long as I've been in the business.
Right. And still doing photography because some of your photography shows up in this book.
That was the other cool thing about it was that I do a lot of photography. And when I'm doing security assessments, like a threat vulnerability assessment at a site, I bring my camera with me and I photograph the vulnerabilities and weaknesses that I find. And the reason I do that is first because I really like taking pictures and it's a good excuse. But secondly, when you put a report together, if you just sort of describe a problem that you found, it may or may not get fixed. But if you take a picture of it,
people
look at it and say, ooh, let's fix it. It's fixed by next Monday morning.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The photographs are so powerful. And so in the book, I have a big section on weaknesses and vulnerabilities. And I show examples that I've seen over the years.
Yeah.
And that was another sort of big lesson that I learned, that I've learned, is that our business, our profession is not great at finding weaknesses and vulnerabilities. I know I've mentioned that already, but it's something that we need to practice.
All right, Ross, final question.
Yes, sir.
And this is the same question I ask everybody that comes onto the podcast, is for a book recommendation. Then we put them all together on our Flux Capacitor book club. So which book are you going to recommend that we add to the list?
So in 2020, a book was published called Ministry for the Future. And I read it, and its first chapter was really one of the most terrifying I've ever read. Science fiction, it's a hard science fiction book, which means that it takes hard science and then creates fiction. It's not stuff like when he describes scientific things, it's for real, right?
Yep.
But what it talked about was a heat wave in India in which the global wet bulb temperature hit 35 degrees Celsius. So, and what that is sort of the temperature of something at like 100% humidity. And we sometimes see something similar to it, like AccuWeather has the real feel, you know, they say it feels like, and, you know, the temperature feels like such and such. What they're really doing is describing like the global wet bulb temperature.
Okay.
And the thing is that our bodies cannot survive a global wet bulb temperature of 35 degrees Celsius or more for very long. So, because you die, essentially. What it means is you've overwhelmed your body's ability to cool itself through evaporation. And so in this book, it's an event where tens of millions of people die because there was this weather event that occurred and also a power failure at the same time.
Oh.
So air conditioning systems and fans and all that sort of stuff weren't working. And so the rest of the book was really, really interesting, but it was this first chapter that really caught my attention. And then a year around that time, we had the 2021 heat dome out here. Now I live on Vancouver Island.
Yeah.
And so this area, the lower mainland of BC, Pacific Northwest, was hit by this heat dome. So, and I remember those events vividly because I realized that the only reason that we were surviving this was because of electricity, because BC Hydro is an outstanding utility with great reliability. And that if we'd have had a power failure, this would have been a public emergency.
Right.
Of the disorder. Now, as it was, 700 people died in British Columbia because of this heat dome. But I remember sitting in my office and I was working in gym swim trunks because it was just too hot.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the interior of the house was 34 degrees Celsius.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't have air conditioning. We had electricity. We didn't have air conditioning. We don't even need fans here.
Yeah.
So we didn't have any of those. So, and I remember it was the first time I've ever really been frightened by the weather in Canada. I thought, I don't know how much longer I can take this. I was sleeping outside at night with the dog because it would go down to 20 Celsius at night. And it also made me realize that electricity is not a nice to have. It's absolutely essential to our lives today.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another reason I'm really glad that this long career path I have has brought me to the electricity sector, because it's a place that I think that you can work in and you can feel proud of the work you're doing. And you know that you're keeping the lights on and helping keep people alive.
Mm-hmm. Well, that certainly connects that book to what it is that you and I have been doing for years now. So the recommendation is The Ministry for the Future, and it's by Kim Stanley Robinson. So Ross, a great addition to our book club. Appreciate that. And thanks for taking the time to come on the podcast. I suspect for those that are interested in security, this was a kind of a fun deep dive. And I appreciate you you taking the time to chat this time.
Thank you very much, Francis. It's good to chat with you again.
For those that have been with the podcast since the beginning and those that have joined along the way, thanks for listening. Tune in for future episodes. Please take the time to rate the podcast on whatever platform you use to listen and let me know what you think of the Flux Capacitor. You can find me on our website at electricity.ca, on LinkedIn, and on Instagram as the Brad Bradley. The website for this pod is thefluxcapacitor.ca, and it includes links for this episode on the show page, this being episode 105. And while you're there, check out the book club page, which provides info on and links to the books which have been recommended by guests on the Flux Capacitor, including Ross's recommendation, The Ministry for the Future by Kim Stanley Robinson. And let's continue the electricity conversation on our Facebook page, on Instagram, and at electricity.ca.